I'm going to call the meeting of the Energy Finance and Policy Division to order. We have a somewhat long agenda to get through today, and we can't wait until 3 o'clock to have members dribble in. So we will start. We have some business to attend to when we have a quorum present, but we do have a number of testifiers. What we wanted to do today is to get what amounts to kind of an annual overview from some of the significant energy providers in the state. To some extent for the benefit of the six new members to the committee, but also I think it's good for all of us to have a kind of review of what our major providers are about and what's new with them. So without further ado, we will get into that testimony. First on the agenda, we have Chris Anderson from Minnesota Power. Anderson, welcome to the committee.
Chair Elke, thank you, members of the committee. I understand that the outline of what I'll be discussing is being handed out to you as I speak here, so I'll start into my overview. Please interrupt me with questions. I'm going to go through this four-page document pretty quickly, and I have a disclaimer at the top already that this, of course, is not an exhaustive review of all regulation of the electric utilities, but
Mr. Anderson, the first thing we need is to have you identify yourself.
Sure. I'm sorry. My name is Chris Anderson. I'm Associate General Counsel of Minnesota Power. And I think what I'll do is go into an overview of regulation both on the federal and state level of electric utilities, spend less time on the federal side, but at least give you a quick overview of what that means. The four utilities, investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota, Minnesota Power, Xcel Energy, Otter Tail Power Company, and Interstate Power and Light, also known as Alliance, are publicly held integrated utilities that provide retail service to electric customers in the state of Minnesota. Our electric utility operations are regulated by state and federal regulators, and on the FERC side, they generally provide review of our wholesale electric power sales and sales to other utilities for resale, as well as an oversight of the transmission grid. Other federal regulators that you may be familiar with, two of the utilities that appear in front of you, National Electric Reliability Council, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, the Securities and Exchange Commission with respect to our securities issuances and stock offerings, the Environmental Protection Agency. And then from a mere perspective on the state side, we have the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, our primary state regulator, regulates our rates and approves all the tariffs and our rate cases and oversees our other utility operations. And involved in the regulatory oversight in the state of Minnesota, the Office of Energy Security of the Minnesota Department of Commerce, the Residential Utilities Division of the Office of Attorney General, and another significant regulator, the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, to the extent that they review the operation of our electricity generators that are located in the state. Primary difference for investor-owned utilities from municipal or cooperative utilities is how the electric rates or the price for the product delivered is both established and regulated. FERC regulates our power sales to other utilities or to sellers for resale through both cost-based rates, through formula-based rates. So there's two different ways that they can do that, essentially using reports that we file on an annual basis to establish an automatic rate mechanism, and then through market rates. Or in other words, there are certain sales that we make within the entire energy market that are at a market rate, at whatever the market will bear, as long as we follow certain tariff procedures. FERC created and monitors the wholesale energy market. They also established regional reliability councils and regional transmission operators. Our region is governed by the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, also known as MISO. They have established both review of the use of the transmission system and, as well as established an energy market that the utilities in this region can participate in. All four of the investor-owned electric utilities are members of MISO. FERC regulates the transmission system that we use. All the utilities are interconnected to each other. The world of transmission interconnection, regulation, and use of that system has been changing over the past few years. There's been quite a move towards open access, making the transmission system essentially a superhighway for energy transactions. While we build, and in some cases operate or control the transmission system through balancing area control agreements and through our transmission operation centers, we cannot restrict anyone from accessing the transmission system. So if an independent generator wants to build, there are rules established by FERC as to how they interconnect to the system itself. We cannot discriminate or prevent someone from interconnecting to the transmission grid, but those who do interconnect need to follow strict rules to ensure the safety and reliability of the system. Interesting intersection you'll see in a number of cases, the transmission system being one of them. While the transmission system itself may be regulated on the federal side, the siting and locating of those transmission lines is a objective of the state overview process. So we will be in front of the state regulators to route or permit the establishment of a transmission line, yet ultimately when that line goes into service, its jurisdiction and use of that line is really a federal obligation. And members of the committee may be familiar with the expansion of the transmission grid or the potential expansion of the transmission grid through the effort underway by the four utilities, investor-owned, as well as cooperation with the municipal and cooperative in the state as far as establishing the CapEx effort to basically increase investment in transmission infrastructure in this region. Now let's get down to the state side where a lot of the action is. I represent Minnesota Power in front of the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission along with another individual in our company, as well as I represent our company in front of FERC. The benefit of being on the state side is you get to know and see your regulators. You get to be in front of them often. They understand more about your company when you're one of four in the state versus one of 50 or 60, it's a lot easier to be paid attention to, so that's nice. The Minnesota Public Utilities Commission regulates energy prices through rate cases and through monitoring and approving costs to Minnesota customers that utilities are allowed to pass through. These include automatic adjustments, things like essentially mirroring, imaging the automatic, the formula-based rates that I referenced on the FERC side. We have automatic adjustment charges, things like our monthly fuel clause on the state side. Riders and other rate adjustments may be put in place. Examples could be related to recent energy legislation coming out of the legislature that authorized the immediate pass-through of certain projects rather than utilizing a rate case to pass those costs on to customers. Again, if the policy objective of the legislature is important enough that they want to see investment in infrastructure occur, they may authorize the Public Utilities Commission to review and establish, allow the utilities to establish a mechanism to pass those rates on through something other than through a rate case. And then also the conservation delivery programs are also a way in which the State Commission regulates electric utility operations. Rate cases are interesting processes. We're undergoing one right now in front of the commission. They're a 10-month plus long process. The utility develops revenue requirements, essentially taking the assets that we have in place to provide utility service and establishing a revenue requirement. Part of the ways in which the utilities have an obligation to serve, but then they are authorized as a quasi-monopoly to receive an adequate revenue requirement to maintain their operations. Rate case interveners include the Office of Energy Security, Residential Utilities Division, but then also individual customers, customer groups, public advocates, consortiums of customers. In our case, Minnesota Power's case, our system is dominated by the 12 industrial customers in northern Minnesota, the paper products and mining companies. They band together and represent themselves in our rate cases and in other proceedings before the commission, so they have a voice. And so you listen to that voice when 60% of your revenues and 60% of your energy delivery is concentrated in that customer base itself. In establishing rates, the Public Utilities Commission pays attention to whether the rates are just and reasonable, that they're not unreasonably preferential or discriminatory amongst the different rate classes that are established for each utility. There's an acknowledgement that the utility should earn a fair rate of return, and there's obviously a lot of time spent establishing what that fair rate of return should be. Rates should be consistent with the financial and economic requirements of the utility provided service. Rates also are meant to establish energy conservation and renewable energy objectives. And finally, any doubt in the reasonableness is determined in favor of the ratepayer. And finally, on the rate front, I think it's important to note that when the utility is granted a rate of return through its rate case, that is not a rate cap. It's not a guaranteed rate of return. It is a rate of return that we are authorized under the review of the commission, reviewing our asset base and our operations. Utilities will earn above or below that rate of return, and we report annually to the commission as to whether or not where we are with respect to that established rate. And if we're consistently coming in low, or we project that we will be coming in much lower than that authorized rate of return over the course of years, we'll come in for a rate case to recover rates properly to provide for our service. Just as the regulators can review our rates, and if we're coming in consistently high with respect to that number, they can require us to file a rate case, or on an intermediate term, they can undertake a rate investigation and have us justify the current rates that we're receiving. The Public Utilities Commission, I guess the picture I'm trying to give you is the Public Utilities Commission has a vast amount of oversight over the utilities, the investor-owned utilities under 216D statute. And they take their job seriously, and they do a good job of overseeing the rates that we are charging our customers. And rate regulation is more than just the energy delivery price itself. They also regulate things like our security issuances, our relations if we have any affiliates that are not utility operations, to the extent that we are involved in any business interests between those two entities. The Public Utilities Commission will ensure that the utility company is not subsidizing the operation of a non-regulated affiliate of its operations. The Public Utilities Commission has the authority to review our property transfers, and they have to approve acquisitions or transfers of property. They also establish depreciation amounts and rates for the assets that we have in rate base, and they also govern our conservation delivery. So that's a brief overview of the extent to which we are regulated, both on the state side and a little bit of an introduction to the federal side for your information. I'll stay here through Mr. Evans' presentation as well. If you don't have questions now, I'm happy to take questions now or at the end of the session.
Do members have questions at this point? Representative Anderson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the, I came in late here, so you may have already covered this, but you talked in here about federal regulators and federal commission, the Federal Regulatory Commission. Do we have, or are you part of, as the Minnesota Power or Xcel Energy, do you have a representative that is a liaison for Minnesota in the Federal Energy Commission in Washington, D.C.? And if so, who is this?
No, the Chair Hilty, representative, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is much like the State Public Utilities Commission. It's a five-member board that's appointed by the president. And when we make filings in front of that commission, either I will represent the company in front of that commission, or we'll have counsel located in Washington, D.C. who will represent our interests to the extent that we ever have to appear in front of FERC. But most of the interaction we have with the federal regulators is on the phone with commission staff when it's allowed and through official filing at the FERC.
Further questions at this time? Representative Atkins.
I hope this is a brief one, Mr. Chair. Thank you. And actually, this could go, I suppose, either you gentlemen, because you have the exposure to the PUC. I understand most of the rate cases that I hear about tend to be utility going in seeking a bump. I'm not familiar with too many situations where it's been the other way around. Are you aware of that occurring? And the second question would be how often, just in a ballpark sense, the target is the rate that's been approved. How common is it for it to be above that or below that?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Hilty, Representative Atkins, it's rare for the Public Utilities Commission to call a company in for a rate case. It has happened, I know it was the recent Otter Tail Power rate case that was just concluded last year. They actually were required to file by the commission through an order with respect to another docket that was in front of the commission. As that docket delved more into Otter Tail's operations, one of the outcomes was a commission requirement in order that Otter Tail come in by a date certain and file a rate case so that the commission and the intervening parties could review Otter Tail's operations. Personal experience with the rate investigation back in 1998, our authorized, I'll back up, our authorized rate of return from our last rate case in 1994 was 11.6%. We filed anywhere from 7% to 13.3%. So the ranges over the years have gone down or gone up depending on what's happened in that year and what your rate base looks like. So it's as much, I think for Minnesota Power, it's been much below the 11.6 as it has been above the 11.6. But you get a flavor then for that variation. In 1998, when we did file that 13% number, the commission did initiate an investigation, and they reviewed changes in our operations since our last rate case, took a look at our financials, reviewed our asset base, and determined at that time that a rate case was not necessary. It would not be a benefit to our rate payers for us to file a rate case.
Further questions at this time? Seeing none, Mr. Evans.
Chairman Hilty, members of the committee, my name is Rick Evans. I'm with Xcel Energy. And I'm just going to pick up a little bit where Chris left off and talk about the operations of investor-owned utilities and particularly with respect to additional regulation beyond the rate regulation that goes forward in our operations. As you're probably aware, utilities in Minnesota have an exclusive service territory that is assigned to them. There are some obligations that come with that and some benefits. We are a monopoly for retail energy in our service territory. That is, we don't have any other utility that can come in and compete with us for our retail customers. That's why the process that Chris just described with the extensive rate regulation is necessary, because we don't have competitors who would ordinarily keep our prices down. And this is a typical structure in most states. Nearly every state has this kind of a structure where they have a regulatory scheme to keep the price down and exclusive territory. One of the things that comes with the exclusive territory is an obligation to serve. We don't have the option of telling a customer or a potential customer that we don't want to sell them power. So within our service territory, we are the exclusive utility, but we also have an obligation to serve any customer, residential or business, that moves into our territory. The construction of utility facilities is a long-range planning process. Large power plants particularly and large transmission lines can take many, many years to plan, develop, build, get approval for, all of those things. And so there's quite a bit of planning that goes with being a regulated utility in terms of demonstrating to the state that we have the resources to provide the energy that our customers are going to demand. In Minnesota, we do that through the resource planning process. Every 2 years, the utilities file a resource plan with the Public Utilities Commission. That's a plan that looks out for 15 years and says, and in which we project how much energy we think our customers are going to demand for us over that period of time, and we demonstrate to the state how we intend to meet that demand. Very much like the process you're going through, where you look at revenues for the state and models are put together and projections are made and you start making plans and planning budgets based on those projections, we do the same thing with energy demand through the planning process. As I said, we file it with the Public Utilities Commission. There is a public proceeding. Any person can come and intervene in the case, can comment. They can say we're underestimating the need. They can say we're overestimating the need. They can ask whether we're using the correct resources, whether there are better resources to be used. So all of that takes place in a public forum with the Public Utilities Commission, culminating in the end with the Public Utilities Commission, and there's a misprint in my outline where it says the Department of Commerce. It's actually the Public Utilities Commission that approves our resource plan that we file every 2 years. The Department of Commerce, of course, is one of the interveners. They come in because they bring a lot of the expertise from the state side to the planning process and how much energy we think we're going to need and how we're going to meet that. For the purposes of you serving on the Energy Committee, it's important for you to know where we get those resources, where we get the power that we sell to our customers. They really come from, broadly speaking, three basic sources. First of all, we build and own our own generation facilities. Xcel Energy, who I work for, owns two nuclear plants, a couple of coal plants, a number of natural gas plants. Those are plants that we own. We built them, and we provide we run those plants and provide energy to our customers. Of course, building a plant also goes through the public utilities process. We need to apply for what's called a certificate of need, often called a CON, C-O-N. We aren't permitted to go out and build power plants until we go to the Public Utilities Commission, even outside of our resource plan, and say, look, we think we need this kind of a plant in this location, and this is the fuel we've chosen, this is how we want to go forward. And we have to get permission, that is the certificate of need, from the Public Utilities Commission before we can go forward with that plan to build our own resources. The other place that we get energy is from long-term contracts, sometimes called PPAs or power purchase agreements. We enter power purchase agreements, often 20-year purchase agreements, where we purchase power from independent companies or owners, developers, that have developed their own generation resources. They are not a regulated utility in most cases. They are a company doing business to produce power. For Xcel Energy, most of our wind resources, for example, we do not own. We own one wind farm, just recently finished a wind farm that we own down in the southern border of Minnesota. It's, I think, about 100 megawatts. We've applied to build some additional wind farms that we will own, but most of the wind energy that we own, that we use, comes from independent developers who have put up wind farms and signed a 20-year contract with us. So we purchase their energy from them and put it on the grid. That's not only true with wind farms. We get a large share of our power from a company called Manitoba Hydro, which runs hydro dams up in Canada. We have long-term contracts with Manitoba Hydro to purchase their energy. We don't own those dams. We don't own that generation. We purchase it from them. We also have some biomass plants. Some of you may have heard out in Benson, Minnesota, we have a turkey manure plant. It's an experimental research and development project that was built under the biomass mandate some years ago, where they burn turkey manure out in western Minnesota, and we purchase their energy. We have a number of places like that. District Energy in St. Paul is another one that burns wood, and we purchase the energy from them under a long-term contract. All of those contracts, by the way, before we can actually enter into them, have to be presented to the Public Utilities Commission, again, and they have to be approved by the Public Utilities Commission before we can enter into them. So once again, the state regulation over what we're doing is present when we purchase that power. And then finally, the last place we get power, which is not our, by any means our first choice, is on occasion we have to just go out onto the open market. There are companies that produce power on the open market that is not committed through a power purchase agreement. Sometimes it's from another utility that might have some excess power on their system at the time. But we go out on the open market and we purchase power. This most often would happen on a peak day where it's very hot, very humid, and the demand has spiked. Possibly we have a power plant that's been that's gone down for some reason or other, either a planned outage or an unplanned outage. And so we have to go out onto the grid, essentially, because, as I started at the beginning of my presentation to say, we have an obligation to serve. We don't have the choice to not sell power to our customers. So when the demand is there, we've got to go get it. Buying energy on the spot market is expensive, so that's not something that we typically want to do. But on occasion, we do that. The state, and you'll find this as you serve on this committee, and those of you that have been on the committee for some years know that the state has placed some requirements on us in terms of how we produce that power and what we do to provide the energy to our customers. All of the investor-owned utilities that Chris talked about have renewable energy standards. That is a law, a state law, that says a certain percentage of our energy that we sell to our customers has to come from renewable energy sources. For most utilities in the state, that means that that standard says that by 2025, 25% of their retail energy has to come from renewable energy. For Xcel Energy, that standard is actually 30% by 2020, and that's due to you don't want to sit here and hear the whole story, but that's due to sort of the history of renewable energy in Minnesota. Xcel Energy has been placed in a position where we can provide more renewable energy and move along a little faster, and so in the standard, the state has required us to do that. We also have an obligation from the state to have conservation programs. Currently, the state goal, the state standard is that each year we have to show that we've achieved conservation of 1.5% of our energy. That is, we have to find ways to get our customers to buy 1.5% less energy than they bought the year before. We're hoping this session and in future sessions as you serve, we'll have an opportunity to talk to you about this, because one of our concerns as a utility is that we're essentially spending a fair amount of money to put ourselves out of business, and that's not a sustainable business model for us. So we'd like to talk to you about how to address that, understanding the important need for conservation. Xcel Energy, for example, next year is going to spend about $50 million on conservation programs. That is $50 million to convince our customers to buy less of our product. And so as we move forward into this new world of conservation, we're going to want to have conversations with each of you about how we can make that work better for the utilities. Obviously, pollution control is an important part of a business like ours that burns so much fossil fuel. A couple of years ago, you passed this committee and the legislature passed an important mercury control bill to reduce the amount of mercury that's coming out of our coal-fired smokestacks by 90%. And by 2010, in some cases in 2014, in other cases due to different technologies on different plants. So that's another requirement that we essentially spend a significant amount of money to achieve those requirements placed on us by the state. We currently have greenhouse gas reduction goals. They're not mandates at this point, but they're goals as we start looking to reduce the amount of greenhouse gases that we emit. And the goals currently contained in statute is that we have to get 15% below the 2005 level of emissions by 2015, 30% below by 2025, and 80% by 2050. So these are obviously long-term goals, but it's a very challenging goal for us, and we're working towards that as an industry. All of these things, these expenditures, whether it's to reduce mercury, whether it's to achieve greenhouse gas emission reduction, whether it's conservation, or purchasing renewable power, all of those have to be submitted to the Public Utilities Commission and approved by them, the expenditures for those items, before we can spend the money. So once again, to achieve the goals that the state has set for us in running our business, we also have to go into the state and show them that we're doing it in the most cost-effective and reasonable way possible before we get approval. One other issue I'll mention, just because I know that Chairman Hilty has determined to have a hearing on it this year, and that is the nuclear issue. We have currently a state law in Minnesota that prohibits utilities from building nuclear power plants. I don't know of any nuclear power plants that are on the drawing board, certainly not in our company. But as nuclear power is a source of power that does not produce greenhouse gases, it has the interest in that source of energy has increased. And so I think sometime during the course of this session, we'll have a hearing to discuss nuclear power, the pros and cons, and the new technologies and ways that we might move forward on that. With that, I'll end my presentation. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I think we have Representative Beard.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Evans, thanks for coming to the committee and talking about all these things again. I've got a couple questions about the rate of return. Your rate of return regulated, as
yes.
I understand?
Yeah, along the lines of Mr. Anderson's presentation on the rate of return
yes.
would apply with equal force dollars.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Evans, see, when we did the MERP program several years ago, we gave you a special rate of return for investing almost $1 billion to clean up the King plant and convert the a couple plants to gas. Do you remember what you're allowed to recover on that, just about?
You know, I'm afraid I don't know the answer to that, but I will get that for you and provide it.
All right. Well, when you generate power, you get a rate of return. Do you remember what that number is? Can you enlighten us about what you can get when you go for a rate case? They don't guarantee you a rate. They allow you to recover up to a certain rate.
Right. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we currently have a rate case before the Public Utilities Commission. I believe we've asked for an 11% rate of return in that. I don't know what our current rate of return is, but we have a new rate case in front of the Public Utilities Commission asking for that rate of return.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Evans, when you build like the wind project you guys have coming online, when you count that capital, you get the same kind of rate of return off the wind as well?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the rate of return, just for the members of the committee that may not know, and Chris will correct me if I get this wrong, but the rate of return is a rate that's applied to the assets owned by the company. So it's not an 11% profit, it's not an 11% on investments or 11% return for our shareholders or anything like that. It's a rate of return calculated on the assets that we own, and that would include wind assets that we own. We don't get a rate of return, obviously, on assets that we purchase the energy through a power purchase agreement. The rate of those costs essentially are just passed through
right.
on an even, you know, dollar for dollar. But for the assets that we own, including wind assets, we earn our rate of return.
Well, Mr. Chairman, then to my last question for now, and there's about a million I could ask, but I'm only going to ask one more right now.
You don't have limitations.
Yeah, given the witness, Mr. Chairman, I'm only going to ask one question. I jest with you, Mr. Evans. The conservation program that we're imposing on investor-owned utilities in particular, all of them, though, in general, that are rate of return regulated, if we're causing you to have a fixed amount of assets on the ground and yet forcing you to reduce your sales every year, what is that doing to that rate of return number? More importantly, what's it doing to the ratepayers that have to make up your rate of return, and how does that enter into your rate case if you care to talk about that? You follow me?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'll give it a shot, and Chris, if you want to jump in on this, feel free. The rate of return that's calculated on the assets is then translated into a rate based on the number of kilowatt hours that we sell. If we sell fewer kilowatt hours because of the success of our conservation programs, for example, then we don't earn that rate of return on essentially the kilowatt hours not sold. And that's why, as I mentioned earlier, we have really financially, we have a disincentive to do the conservation. We have a legal requirement, and we have a very active and program that we're frankly very proud of, but from a strictly financial point of view, there is a disincentive to doing the conservation because we don't earn the rate of return on those kilowatt hours that aren't sold.
That's probably a very confusing answer. I don't know if you understand.
I think I understood it entirely, but
Mr. Anderson, did you have something to add?
Mr. Hilty, Representative, but the only piece I would add to that is maybe seen a little bit as rate case advocacy. So I hope those that are in the room that are participating in our rate case don't see it differently than for how I intend it. The biggest concern that we have while we're in a rate case, when we have the requirement to put assets on the ground or to acquire energy in the marketplace, is the utility earning a fair rate of return from the utility commitment to the rate cases so that the cost of our investment in infrastructure is easier for us to fund and is beneficial to our ratepayers. So in other words, if a low return that could be allowed by the commission in a rate case will actually harm us financially in the investment community, make it harder for us to acquire capital at a low rate. So there's a symbiotic relationship between the rate case and the return that's allowed in the rate case as to how that's viewed by the investment community and then how that impacts our cost of capital, then not only for those specific projects, for all of our operations.
Thank you.
Representative Cahill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Evans, I think I heard you misspeak, and so I just want to give you a chance to correct on the conservation goal, that it's the goal is not actually, the 1.5% goal is not a nominal drop of 1.5%. So if we're selling 100 megawatt hours this year, we're not asking you to sell 98.5 megawatt hours next year. It's that if you're selling 100 megawatt hours this year and projected next year to get to 102 megawatt hours, we're asking you to sell only 100 and work with the customers to only consume 100.5. So dropping that expected growth rate from 2% down to 0.5% on a statewide basis, is that your...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I believe that's correct.
Okay.
And thank you for correcting.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Evans, I do think it's an important distinction because it is not asking you to go out of business slowly. It's really asking to mitigate the impact of a significant growth model that we've been on that clearly is not sustainable. I know that Xcel has proven your commitment to being a partner in mitigating that impact and being a real responsible corporate citizen. I just want to appreciate and applaud you for that. One other quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, and that is...
Representative Cahill.
I'm just wondering for both testifiers, if you see yourself as providing a product to your customers or a service?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Anderson.
I think both. We provide a commodity, electricity, that certainly from the industrial side, our customers are highly dependent upon us to provide at a low cost and at a reasonable price for their operations. So we're very sensitive, as I indicated, to the cost of our product and the impact it has in the financial outlook of the customer base, but also from residential customers. We went a long time before we filed our rate case recently. We knew what the impact would be on the customers. Some of the comments we received from those who appeared at our public hearings, the individuals would say, well, you know, we're not opposed to the company earning a fair rate of return. It was fascinating to see residential customers actually say this in a public hearing. We're not opposed to a company that's earning a fair rate of return. What we don't like is that it's been maybe a sudden impact of a large increase over time. And, you know, that's hard to manage that. You know, when's the right time to file a rate case if you see your asset base increasing and your cost of service increasing? So flipping it, though, from a product perspective to a service perspective, our partnership with our communities in northern Minnesota we take very seriously, and that's why we invest in the community, not just as a utility, in the reliable infrastructure we have to deliver the energy product, but that's why we also participate in economic development programs, or in the past, as the Duluth economy was failing, we invested in the paper mill that's now operated by NewPage. You know, we started a process that someone else was able to carry forward. When LTV went into bankruptcy in 2001, we were able to not only acquire some of their operations that they use for electricity generation within the confines of their own facility, use that for our customers for their benefit, but we also acquired some of the land and other operations that we could then help assist Cleveland Cliff, who we went into partnership with, to essentially recover the LTV assets, and now they can be used for PolyNet and Savvy Nuggets and some of the other infrastructure that's there. So I see it as both.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Representative Kalin, I think you know that's probably a good answer. I covered the whole waterfront.
Mr. Chair.
I apologize,
Mr. Evans and Mr. Chair. We're not the Senate.
We'll talk about that later.
Thank you,
Mr. Evans.
I forgot what the question was. No, I agree with Mr. Anderson's answer. I guess I would say that the committee understands, the only way we make money is selling kilowatt hours of electricity to our customers. So if you think of kilowatt hours of electricity as a commodity or a product, then that's the product that we make money on. However, we have an obligation to provide reliable service. We spend a lot of time making sure that the system is up and system is working in order to deliver that product. So I imagine in some respects, additional respects, you could consider it a service. But we don't, for example, charge people except through the kilowatt hour process for providing the reliable service.
Members, we have four testifiers yet to appear on the agenda. I did have Representative Falk on the list, and we kind of jumped over him. I'll entertain that question, then we're going to have to move on. Representative Falk.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To both testifiers, you said you're allowed to earn your rate of return on your pool of assets, and being that you represent both for-profit entities, is there, as you believe, an incentive to increase your pool of assets to thus drive profitability, or to spread that rate of return over a larger amount of dollars?
Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, the best way to respond to that question, Representative, is that the Public Utilities Commission is only allows us to earn a rate of return on assets that are used and useful. So the process that Mr. Evans discussed, when you add generation or distribution assets or transmission assets into your rate base, the Public Utilities Commission will review that in your rate case to make sure that those assets are used and useful. So they will not allow us to run up our asset base simply to earn a rate of return. You still need to provide the kilowatt hour service to support your asset base itself. In our particular case, we've held the line on our assets for quite a while, but as time goes on, there's only so much incremental reliability improvements you can make before you need to increase the efficiency of your generation, also to meet new environmental standards, or to increase your transmission infrastructure to ensure its reliability. So I think there's a check and balance system in place to make sure that our assets are used and useful before that we're allowed to earn a return on them from our customers.
Chair, members of the committee, I agree with everything Mr. Anderson said. In addition, there is a consideration taken when we file resource plans. As the Public Utilities Commission looks at the balance between the owned resources and purchased resources, and that is part of the balance that we strike. They look at when we go in to propose either a power purchase agreement or the construction of a new generation facility, one of the questions they'll ask is, what are the alternatives? And they will look for the lowest cost, most reliable alternative. So all of those questions that have to do with whether we should own the asset or whether we should purchase the energy outside are all addressed to the Public Utilities Commission, which again is a public process that all of the public can participate in. So, that's the best answer I can give to your question, is that there's a balance to be struck between these assets, these sources of energy, and that's part of the Public Utilities role, Public Utilities Commission's role.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next on the agenda we have Mr. Sundberg. Sundberg, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Lee Sundberg with the Minnesota Rural Electric Association. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'll be referring to the walk down the handout, the slide or the PowerPoint handout that is available. I hope. Yep. Our association represents 44 distribution cooperatives around the state and 6 generation and transmission cooperatives that provide the power or the wholesale service to those 44 distribution co-ops. They serve a little over 740,000 customers around the state, which is about a quarter of the customers. And 92% of those are residential. Very high number of farm and non-farm residential. And as you might imagine, serving out in the rural areas, the average income is about 80% of the state average. We range in size from 2,000, a little under 2,000, which have large service territories, to 122,000 in the with the outgrowth of the metro area. But our median size is about 6,400. So the larger co-ops serving out in the suburbs are kind of the exception to the rule.
He's talking about the number of customers.
Yes, yes, Mr. Chair, number of customers. Our service area covers geographically 85 to 90% of the state. And to do that, we need 122,000 miles of distribution line, which, as indicated, is enough to go around almost 5 times around the world. And we have an average number of customers per mile of line of about 6, which in some cases it goes down to 2, a little less than 2. At an average cost of a pretty good competitive cost with those lines and numbers of a little over 8 cents. So with that data, I'm kind of giving you a background of who we are and who we serve. We are governed more by the cooperative association law rather than the incorporated under that for organization and structure, which gives each of our members, each of those 741 customers, a vote in our structure and operations with locally elected boards of directors ranging in size from about 7 to 13 board members on the local co-op. We're a nonprofit, and we distribute our funds or use the funds in capital credits for infrastructure improvements and returned later to the customer based on the amount of usage. We have regular meetings, at least an annual meeting, monthly board meetings, and members can call special meetings if they wish. Our board of directors regulate the rates, but the members can vote to be also rate regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, and one of the 44 distribution co-ops has elected to do that. In addition, I should just mention too that the Rural Utilities Service, the Federal Rural Utilities Service based out of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the old REA, does provide some oversight and guidance also over the some of the financial and operations of the activities of the co-op. Even though we are incorporated under the cooperative association law, there still are a good number of specific statutory provisions that we fall under, including the cold weather disconnections and other residential customer protections that we specifically abide by. And ability to pay is, you know, is always a concern. Especially lately, with the foreclosures and numerous vacant homes. Our numbers are showing delinquencies are growing at a high rate, and I suspect that the 2008 numbers are going to show a record in that number, unfortunately. And the around the both the metro suburban area and outstate, the residential and commercial growth seems to have pretty much come to a standstill. But getting back to the statutory provisions, we also have policies regarding outages and distribution system safety, reliability and service quality, and distributed generation interconnection rates, and this co-op policy that is, follows very closely to the PUC rules, if not exactly following those rules. Even though we're not rate regulated, moving to the next page, even though we're not rate regulated by the Public Utility Commission except for Dakota Electric, we do fall under numerous PUC regulations, including certificate of need and siting of power plants and large transmission lines. As Mr. Evans was talked about the obligation to serve in assigned service territories, and I'll talk a bit about that in a bit more. And you can see other other laws that the co-ops can come under just as much or as the some of the investor-owned or all of the investor-owned utilities, including the SIPS program, renewable energy mandate, and integrated resource planning, and so on. And furthermore, there's one thing that we have that's special, in that if a customer of ours is not satisfied with the response or answer that he gets from the local co-op, that customer can file a formal complaint with the Public Utilities Commission, and then the commission takes jurisdiction in over that. So members do have recourse if they do not achieve satisfaction at the local co-op. This is not regarding to rates, however, this is service. Because of our demographics and our area that we serve, I wanted to emphasize the importance of service territory, where we too have a legal obligation to provide reliable service at reasonable rates. The statutory reasons given for exclusive service areas are, to develop and maintain coordinated statewide service. I think we know from experience and history that uncoordinated service can get a little bit expensive and very unreliable, if not non-existent. Also have assigned service areas to eliminate or at least try to avoid unnecessary duplication of very capital-intensive facilities. And so you don't see numerous lines going down the same street or a right-of-way either. So in general, we want to promote the economical, efficient, and adequate service. The Public Utilities Commission and the courts have also made it clear in their statements that service areas provide stability and predictability in the planning and rates, and that rates should not determine service areas. Rates can fluctuate from time to time, from utility to utility, up and down. So to be moving service territories each time somebody has a rate case or rates go up would not be good for planning and would not provide coordinated service. And nevertheless, the PUC can change service areas if the if it finds it would be in the public interest to do so. And on the next page, but even though they are exclusive, there are three exceptions to that. Exclusivity, if the utilities consent to a change, that then if it's the engineering and economics indicate that it makes sense to do that, we do switch some areas. Another exception is that there's a large customer over 2,000 kilowatts or 2 megawatts in size outside of the city limits. That load can be bid. And in fact, well, bid's not a good word. petition can be made to the Public Utilities Commission, and based on engineering and economic basis stated in the law, the commission can make a determination on which utility should serve that that large load. And finally, the other exception is when a municipal utility or city with its own municipal utility, after they annex an area and make compensation to the cooperative or to the investor-owned utility, they can acquire the area. And this that exception applies only to cities that do have their own utility. Just want to say a few words on the renewable energy law that was passed 2 years ago. All of our co-ops, the G&Ts, 60 Generation and Transmission Cooperative, they are on track or ahead to meet the renewable energy standard. The next step is 12% by 2012. Again, we're on track or ahead to meet that. And with every, you know, with plans to meet the 25% by 2025. Transmission is a very important aspect of that, as was demonstrated in the 2007 wind integration study upon which the mandate was based, technically. And so we look forward to the, we need the transmission as well to help meet the 25%. We do have a few concerns that we've been seeing. These are not, you know, huge red flags at this point, but we're seeing or getting some indication, just concerns about the recession hurting the financing for renewable energies. I think I've been reading that in numerous publications, including the Washington Post, so I don't think that's not a single observation on my part. I think coming in pretty maybe basic knowledge of what the recession is doing to financing of many industries. With the wind not blowing when it's needed most of the time off peak and without storage yet, it points out to the need to continue research and development towards the technology on storage. The competition for resources and commodities came pretty clear in this last year or so when the price of a megawatt hour doubled, if not more so. Now with the recession, it may or has already gone down. And finally, we're concerned about additional state mandates that may come about. When the 25% was passed in 2007, the assumption or the understanding we thought was that we would be able to accomplish the 25% mandate in the most efficient and cost-effective way, and we would like to maintain that flexibility to do that. Finally, on conservation, this has already been touched on, and I'll just kind of repeat that. So we were planning, and we're taking each of our distribution co-ops and generation transmission co-ops are taking steps to implement the law for 2010, but we do have some, again, concerns. We'll be talking with, working with the department and with others to try to look at some of these issues. Again, pointing out the with decreased usage from the recession plus the 1.5%. The three-year averaging sure helps with that. And as it would with any surge in consumption when hopefully soon the recession ends, but you know, how to flatten out a bit those spikes and dealing with other anomalies and the usage. I think we need to figure out how to deal with downward spirals. The recession is making it harder, we're finding, for our customers to invest in conservation. It may make sense in the long term, but when you're in a steep recession, the long term is harder to for many commercial customers to make a decision, and residential as well, to make that type of investment. And probably most important for us, again, I want to emphasize how many of our customers are residential, And with few commercial and industrial, then it's difficult to get a sizable kilowatt hour savings with just with so many residential customers. Again, we just need to try to work something out, talk with the department, talk with Representative Kalin, and how we can move this or work this with residential. And finally, one other final point we're working with the department on, hope to keep talking with the department about, is education and training, how to count it, if at all. It did count when we had the 1.5% spending, but since it doesn't directly lead to a lot of our savings, it doesn't count. I know when we passed the law, we talked about how we're going to need behavioral changes. We're going to need lots of shifts in how people act and behave, but yet we can't count it indirectly. So we'd like to continue to work with that. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's all.
Thank you, Mr. Cumberg. Representative Welty.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and to Mr. Thunberg. I had a question related to the comment that you made that when on your bullet point here under renewable energy, it said competition for resources and commodities, and then you said the cost of a megawatt nearly doubled recently. Can you clarify that for me, what your comment was?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Welty. The cost of wind, I'll talk about wind, was about $1 million a megawatt back, 5 years ago? And it's been growing to now it's double, at least double that, because of with the cost of turbines, steel, cement, labor, all of those added together. I can't give you an exact number, but I know it's at least double for the cost of a megawatt of wind power. Again, resource, commodities, of all kinds. Now, again, because of the economic downturn, I suspect, some of the prices of cement and other resources have decreased already, so I suspect we may see a decrease of that. Hopefully.
Mr. Sundberg, thank you. Representative Welty, we are going to have to move along. All right. If you want to pursue this, perhaps you could do it after the meeting. Mr. Sundberg is generally pretty readily available in these calls.
I'll try to make myself.
Representative Westrom.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sundberg, you talked about the PUC regulation over one of the 44 territories or co-ops. What led to that move, and does the PUC have the right to review any disputes or issues with your co-ops with a petition or anything like that, or is everything just left up to your board unless they themselves petition to be in under the PUC rule?
Mr. Steinberg.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, the reason for the vote was back in the early 80s when Coal Creek Station came online and rates were increasing considerably, and that's what very high rates led to the vote for in Dakota Electric territory based out of Farmington to have the rates reviewed by the Public Utilities Commission. And the second part of your question dealt with the rates and service complaints before the commission. If the complaint is filed by a member dealing with rates, the commission has not dealt with that because the law is pretty clear. Again, unless it's Dakota Electric, that's different. But if a formal complaint is filed dealing with a service standard by one of the 43 unregulated co-ops, the commission can pick that up and deal with it.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Mr. Sundberg,
Representative Weston.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Sundberg, what have you done any analogy of the Dakota Electric rates compared to an average or most of your other individual co-ops? What is the rate done in Dakota versus any of the other co-ops? Are they right all on the same range within a tenth of a penny, or is Dakota higher or lower, or any, has there been any trend or noticeable difference?
Mr. Sundberg?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Westrom, I've not done any analysis, but the back of my back of pocket tells me that the difference is so, it can be so much between or among co-ops based on the, not just the power cost, but the distribution aspect as well, so that potentially Dakota Electric would have a lower rate compared to the co-op up in the northeastern part of the state with a lot more interest, many more lines and far fewer customers. Did that address?
Yeah. Sundberg, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the time.
Black. Black, welcome to the committee. And clearly, we are running short on time, so anything you can do to abbreviate your presentation would be appreciated.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Bill Black from the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association. I've kind of reduced my presentation to this PowerPoint, and I'll try to speed through it and take questions at the end if there's any that I can answer. I'm not the wealth of information that Mr. Sundberg is, but I hope maybe providing you some materials here that are being handed out would give you something to take home with you, too. So I'll move through. I'd like to start just by talking briefly about what MMUA is about, and then moving into sort of the structure of the municipal utilities for Minnesota. Everyone's got a mission statement, and usually it's only the people working there who think it's important, but this does make sense to us that we unify and serve as a common voice for municipal utilities and to provide them with support they need to be able to improve service to their customers and communities. This is a map of all the municipal electric and gas utilities in the state of Minnesota. We represent all of them. There are 125 municipal electric utilities and 31 gas utilities. MMUA has been around for 78 years now. So, in fact, this picture here is from the directory from 1933. So I just thought that would be a good illustration. And in order to bring your attention to this one, this is our 2006 directory. It was from our 75th anniversary. We make one every year and have since 1931. But this one's the most interesting. It's got a lot of history about the municipal utilities in the state, a lot of good pictures and a lot of good information. So wanted to share that with you. And I'll also mention that we brought you our current issue of The Resource, our monthly newsletter, and Missouri River Energy also provided you a pamphlet on its renewable efforts. Every year, we bring 75 to 90 of our municipal utility managers, utility commissioners, mayors to the Capitol here and have a conference and invite members of leadership and energy committee chairs to discuss the issues with us. And we appreciate your participation with us, Mr. Chair, and hope you can join us again in March. We also take our folks to Washington, D.C. We have one of the largest contingents in the United States of municipal utility representatives at the American Public Power Association Legislative Conference in Washington. This is a picture of us last year discussing issues with Senator Klobuchar. We had just about every member of the delegation join us last year and the year before. Beyond government relations, MMUA does a lot of more practical, interesting on-ground work for our members. This is the MMUA Training Center in Marshall, Minnesota, where we do a lot of training of municipal and, I believe, some cooperative linemen, line workers. A lot of training goes on there in cooperation with the city of Marshall. This are some of the folks that are involved in that line worker career development program. The gentleman on the far right works out of Plymouth, but is all over the state, and is a real professional with a lot of experience in line work training and safety management. And this is our safety management team. They live all around the state. They're employees of MMUA, and they provide vital services to municipal utilities and also broader city government administrative purposes with OSHA compliance. Also work with the League of Minnesota Cities to provide regulatory compliance for local government. Other services that we provide include a gas operator qualification program, utility management. Occasionally when a very small utility has transitioned from one management to another and there's a gap in between, we actually have personnel with experience enough to stand in on a temporary basis and actually manage a municipal utility. And that's become necessary in the past couple of years. Mutual aid, when there are disasters, we coordinate among our municipal utilities, not only in the state, but in the bordering states, and send teams across the country to help with disaster relief on the utility side. We also have a finance program that helps local governments, municipal utilities, get projects going when they receive federal funding, state funding, or to issue bonds on their behalf or to coordinate with them. And something we're very proud of is the ReliTrack computer reliability reporting system that helps our municipal utilities comply with state regulations for reporting on their outages and their reliability issues that they have. That's it on MMUA. I can give some background and some basics on municipal utility structure and probably refer questions that are beyond my experience to people that can get answers for you, but I'd be happy to try to answer any you have. Again, these are the municipal utilities in the state, just to show you how that overlaps a little bit with this map of the electric utility service areas. This includes all the utilities of all the types. It's very hard to see on this, but you notice, like Mr. Sundberg said, the cooperatives really do occupy a lot of the area, but you see that the blue areas are the municipal utilities, and they are within their city boundaries. I mentioned that just to add again the service territory issue. Service territories are locked except for in the exceptions that Mr. Sundberg mentioned, the exception where municipal utilities grow with the city boundaries. That just comes when a city grows, naturally its services extend with the other services it provides. And this is the statute that kind of summarizes that for you. Kind of hard to read on your printout page, so I thought I'd put it up for you. Municipal utilities are governed either by a local utility commission or by the city council of the municipality. Governance in the 125 municipal electric utilities is nearly evenly split between these two methods, utility commission or city council. Where the municipal utilities are governed by a local utilities commission, commissioners are generally appointed by the city council. In two cities, Blue Earth and Austin, commissioners are elected. Municipals are subject to all the state's laws regarding public bodies, including Data Practices Act, open meeting law, public bidding laws, and recent government ethics laws. No other utility invites as much public input nor operates in such an open to democratic manner. Open accessible governance is one reason municipals are also known as public power utilities. The story that I hear most often from managers is they were in the local coffee shop and were approached by any number of people to comment to them on the rate increase. They hear about it as directly as you hear from your constituents on issues. For example, this is the Blooming Prairie Public Utilities Commission. I should mention that the rate-making authority that the state utility commission has over the rate-regulated utilities is reflected at the local level by these local municipal utility commissions who set the rates, either by the commission or by the city council, depending on how that city operates. but that's a similar operation to the state's version of a public utility commission. And just for interest sake, these are the municipal utilities that are represented by members of House representatives in this room on this policy division. There are 13 members of the 20, I think, that have municipal utilities in their district. So these are who they are. The municipal utilities are operated and managed by city employees, so they've got a lot of interests here at the Capitol that are not exactly energy related, and we keep an eye out for those too. Anything that affects city employees the way that would affect state employees, you know, employment matters, retirement, those kinds of things. This is the St. James Public Utility Crew, and actually the gentleman on the far right is now an MMUA employee who is the person who is able to manage utilities on their behalf of the cities when they need an interim management, and he does a great job. Some statistics on municipal utilities. The largest electric utility by customers is Rochester, with the number you can see there. Moorhead, 15,000 or so customers, and then Shakopee. Gas utilities, Duluth is definitely the largest, with, I believe, around 24,000 customers. I'm not sure about that number, though. But we also represent the gas utilities, and they have issues as well. Smallest electric utilities, all the way down to 55 customers in Neillsville. So we've got a broad range. The average municipal electric utility has 2,831 customers, and that number is a little misleading because there's so many, there's some very large ones and some very small ones. So the median is 1,230 customers. 14% of the electricity in Minnesota flows through municipally owned and operated systems. A little bit about where we get our power. Power supply comes mainly from Western Area Power Administration, which is hydropower off the Missouri River System, and from municipal power agencies. I'm going to talk a little bit about those two, but there are also generation that goes to municipal systems through generation and transmission cooperatives, investor-owned utilities, small amount from municipal utilities' own generation, and occasionally from the MISO market, which tends to be more expensive and avoided when possible. These are the customers in Minnesota that receive federal allocation of hydropower from the Missouri River System. And the Missouri River Energy Services is the municipal power agency that represents most of them here in Minnesota. You'll see on these coming slides the ones that are in italics, our WAPA customers. Missouri River, I think I mentioned, handed out a brochure and has a lot of good, useful information on their operation. I'm just going to go through the six municipal power agencies on the slide so you can take a look to see their names and the members of those agencies. CMMPA, located in Blue Earth. MMPA, closer to home, based in Minneapolis, mostly western municipalities west of the Twin Cities. NMPA up in Thief River Falls, Five Power in conjunction with Minn Kota Power Cooperative. SIMPA, you hear a lot of, based in Rochester. And Heartland Consumers Power District is not a Minnesota organization, but sells power into the Minnesota municipal system, from Marshall, Medelia, Truman, and Tyler. And finally, we have all the rest of these municipal utilities that are not members of a joint action agency, municipal power agency. And they deal a little bit more with issues on their own. They purchase power separately and individually from the range of possible power suppliers, and do a little more of their conservation planning on their own with some help from us at MMUA. I've got just a couple more slides. I wanted to mention just a couple of the challenges faced by the public power community in Minnesota. This is at Litchfield celebrating Public Power Week. Not sure what year that was taken. But generally speaking, renewable energy in preparing for this, I tried to get as much information as I could from the range of municipal utilities and power agencies. I don't have a lot of specifics, but I did want to put on the board here the landfill gas generation system at Elk River. A lot of folks, you know, you can always put up a wind turbine picture. You've probably seen a million of them. Not a lot of people think about a facility like this when they're thinking about renewable energy, but I know that Mora, Minnesota, is looking at landfill gas. Glencoe has had a lot of success with landfill gas power generation as well. And we continue to move forward steadily on meeting our standards. I think all the municipal power agencies are on track to meet their 2010 renewable energy standards, so or exceed. So a lot of positive movement in that direction. On the conservation front, this is a photo from Delano. Municipal utility contracted with the National Honor Society to have those folks make some money by delivering compact fluorescent light bulbs to all the customers in town. And that was a great success. Like I said, we have we're working, MMUA has staff working with the Office of Energy Security to develop the deemed savings program for conservation programs, providing technical support and input to finally get going on charting and calculating the savings by all the different energy programs that the utilities are utilizing in order to meet their 1.5 standards.
Mr. Black, I think we're going to have to ask you to end your presentation.
My last one.
We're actually at the end of our committee time. Although since most members arrived 10 or 15 minutes late, we're going to ask you to pay back that time so that we can accommodate the people from the gas utilities, one of whom is from out of state. Otherwise, we might ask them to defer until another time, but I think under the circumstances, we'll just ask them to go ahead and try to give us a brief presentation.
I don't know how to run this. Is there a...
While he's coming up here, let me
introduce... Help is on the way.
Thank you very much. Well, while he's coming up, let me introduce myself. My name is Mike Wessler, and I'm the Senior Director of Certificate of Internal Affairs for Northern Natural Gas. I appreciate the opportunity to address this commission. I do live in Omaha, and before I came up here, my seven-year-old son asked me where I was going, so we Googled Minnesota. And he said, "That's awful dang close to the North Pole, isn't it, Dad?" And I almost had to agree. I'm going to tell you...
I've been here the last week, Mr.
I am going to be very brief. My objectives are really twofold. Number one, to let you know that where Northern is in the community here in Minnesota, and to kind of explain the role of an interstate natural gas pipeline and how it relates to your business here. We're federally regulated, so we're not going to have a lot of business before your committee. Nonetheless, Northern has a very important presence in the state. Northern Natural Gas was established 78 years ago. We are headquartered in Omaha, Nebraska. We have marketing offices in Minneapolis and in Houston, as well as Omaha. We have 15,100 miles of pipeline that extends from South Texas and goes up to from where a lot of our supplies are, and it goes to the upper Midwest. It goes to Iowa, Minnesota, Wisconsin, and parts of the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. We have five storage facilities. Three of them are underground storage facilities, one in Redfield, Iowa, one in Cunningham, Kansas, and one in Lyons, Kansas. And then we also have two LNG peaking facilities, and one of them is in your state in Renshaw, and the other one is in Garner, Iowa. Between the storage facilities, we have a firm capacity of about 73 BCS. Storage services are very important in this volatile economy when gas prices are going up and down, because it allows our customers to take some gas that is very cheap, to park it in storage, and then to bring it out onto the market when those market needs go. We provide both transportation and storage services. We have about 76 utilities and numerous end users. I don't have an exact number because we have marketers that come in and are our customers and go back in and out. I should mention that we are in 11 states. Our market area is generally that area that is north of an imaginary line, just north of Clifton, Kansas. So some Nebraska and some of the states above that.
Northern Natural Gas is a company that's owned by Mid-American Energy Holdings Company. That is the Buffett company. They also own some pipeline over in Nevada and California and Utah, and they also own some electrical and other distribution, including MEC in the state of Iowa. Here in Minnesota, Northern is proud of its our community presence here. We have 103 people in the state. We have 8 field operations offices, and as I mentioned, we also have a marketing office in Minneapolis. About 32, after the expansions I'm going to talk about, we'll have about 3,300 miles of pipeline out of the 15,000 that will be in the state of Minnesota. Unlike other natural gas pipeline, interstate pipelines that come into the state, Northern is a little bit different because we're more of a web-like configuration. Most of the other interstate pipelines are trunk-like. They just have one big, maybe 42-inch diameter pipeline to come in and drop off the gas to the LDC. We have a lot of branch lines because back in our history, we tended to build out to the community, and we continued that kind of spider-like development when we came up into these states here. Northern serves about 60 end users in this state, and our throughput per year is about 367 BCF. I should also mention that Northern serves serves 13 of the 19 existing ethanol plants in the United in this state, and we serve about 27% of all ethanol producing plants nationwide. We benefit from two things. First, our geographic presence, where the corn is, so that's a great geographic advantage to us. The second advantage is our web-like configuration is so that if a ethanol-producing plant wants to locate in a rural part of a state, you know, our pipeline's already there. We can build out to them because we're closer to those facilities. We have Northern has about 5.1 BCF of certificated contracts for the 2008-09 winter season. And we just hit a peak record of delivery January 14th and January 15th when we exceeded 4.8 BCF of actual deliveries of natural gas into our market area. I want to briefly go over the Northern Lights project. The Northern Lights project, the genesis of this project, occurred when we were facing a competitive situation about 4 to 5 years ago. We entered into long-term agreements with some of our largest customers, including Xcel and CenterPoint, that we would have this long-term contract that we would meet their growth needs every 2 years through the year 2026. From that commitment came the Northern Lights project. The Northern Lights project first started in 2005. I mentioned that we were federally regulated. We're regulated by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. For the 2007 project that you see here, that 398,000 dekatherms a day represented almost a 10% growth in our delivery to the market area. A very significant project, and you can see that it was in Iowa and a large part was in Minnesota. That went into service in November 1st in 2007. A couple things of note. Number one, we were one of the first companies to use the first pre-filing process. And that pre-filing process was set up so that landowners and environmental interests had an upfront say in project development and route determination. So it was kind of usually used to go out and put your project out there, and then people would come into the docket and say, well, here's what we think is wrong, here's the environmental concerns. They first kind of flip-flop that, and now we're working with a lot of landowners and a lot of stakeholder interests up front. When we did the 2007 project, for instance, we had 6 open houses up in the Minneapolis area and then one down in the Iowa area. We also have things like dedicated websites, quarterly newsletters, and other stakeholder outreach that made this project possible. One of the things I want you to note from this slide is an increasing share of natural gas that is used for power generation. Mm-hmm. Generally, you know, through the years, most of our natural gas was used for commercial residential consumption, but a growing part is being used for power generation as power companies look for ways to meet renewable portfolio standards or look for cleaner energy. And notice too here, for the 2007 project, about a third, 29%, was used for ethanol production and to serve ethanol plants. You'll see that number kind of slide down in the project as we go along. You can see the facilities there. One of the things that Northern does when we go and we do our expansions, because we have such a web-like configuration, we often look to see if we can't just run along our existing easements and either make the pipe bigger or loop the pipe. this helps to minimize the impact on landowners. And so that's something that we're very proud of. For this project, we had about 15 miles of what we call greenfield pipeline. When we got that certificate from the FERC in 2007, there was actually a component that had predetermined construction that was going to happen in 2008, and that's what this slide represents. A much smaller figure because we wanted to meet the basic needs of our customers, and we also have some ethanol loads that had to be served, and then 48% or about half went to the core market that your residential commercial business use. You can see that the that this did include an expansion of our mainline facilities. We were able to take about 3 to 4 miles of pipeline, 42-inch pipeline that exists just south of the Minnesota border, and we expand that so that we don't have to do so much branch buying and compression. Another thing I want to point out is during this construction, we were very cooperative with state agencies in the state of Minnesota for the construction that happened here. Not only did we work within the FERC guidelines, which are very extensive in terms of environmental and stakeholder interests, but we also entered into an agreement with the Minnesota Attorney General with an agreement called the Ag Land Impact Mitigation Agreement. And what that did is set up specific construction and dispute resolution procedures whenever Northern was on agricultural land. To date, because of the good work I think that we do, we have not had a single dispute that has gone to that plan, because we've been constructing in accordance with its principles, which that deals everything from waste removal to compaction of soil to restoration to tile and everything like that. The next project I'm very excited to tell you is past the drawing board. It's sitting there at the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. It's docketed at PFO 911. We didn't really like that docket number, but I guess somebody has to get 911. It's a much smaller project because remember that we met most of the growth needs through the first project back in 2005-2007. The facilities for this project will go into service in November 1st, 2009, and then a smaller number again November 1st, 2010. Again, notice the concentration, about 39% of that is going to power generation, a little bit smaller towards ethanol. And what does this all mean for the state of Minnesota? You can see from this figure that there's a lot of capital investment. These are just projects within the state of Minnesota from the Northern Lights Project. There are other projects in the state of Nebraska and the state of Iowa, but about 60% of the capital investment is in the state of Minnesota, and about 66%, almost two-thirds, of the gas that's going to be delivered through this project, the incremental gas that's going to be delivered, is for use by Minnesotans. And like you see, $214 million invested in the state, forecast through 2011. So nothing would be good without, how does that conclude? This expansion is important not only for our growth, but it's also important because it meets the growing needs of Minnesotans. The Minneapolis area, for a while, was one of the largest increasing demand for natural gas in the country. So Northern was proud to be a part of being able to deliver that gas to the state of Minnesota. In addition, you see that it pays dividends for your local communities in terms of increased tax base. If you just look at the numbers, the amount of property tax assessment in the state has gone up about 14% since 2006. I promised to be brief. I was.
Thank you, Mr. DeLauper. One question. We know that none of the natural gas that is consumed in Minnesota is produced in Minnesota. What is your major production source?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's a great question. Northern Natural Gas accesses five major what we call supply bases. Our recent interconnection with the REC interconnect line brought more Rocky Mountain gas. So we have Rocky Mountain gas, we have gas from Canada that we have access to, we have gas from the West Cupidon area in Kansas, and we also have offshore facilities, and we can bring gas up from there. We also have gas basins in lower Texas where that's a little bit more what I would call high sulfur gas, so a lot of that gas has to be processed before it's put onto our system. But we have a wide, diverse supply that we can reach to bring to our market area. I hope that answers your question.
It does, and Mr. Laffer, what is your current assessment of the status of your reserves?
Well, If you don't mind, I have a slide that I brought, and I'm going to see if I can access this. Can I have my technical person, please? Oh, there he is. I do have a map, and I'm hoping to give it up. Get it up here. If not, I will show. I will leave this copy with you. This is a presentation that we made for another commercial presentation from our company. And what this does is it shows the natural gas basins, you know, and the estimated years of production from each of those basins. Oh, I see. And just by way of narrative, if this comes into focus, Northern has access to Rocky Mountain gas, or there it is, that's the one right there. That's checked for most of the
Yeah.
Northern has access to Rocky Mountain gas through our Rec Center Connect. We have access to Canadian gas through Viking and Northern Border. Our facilities go down into the West Texas area, and we also access off the Gulf of Mexico. And not really shown there is the Hugoton facility in Kansas, and those reserves are hard depleting. The ones in Kansas are depleting quite rapidly. But you can see the average number of years that we have estimated using information from public sources of the number of years of gas supply that are left in those basins.
At current rate,
absolutely. And I'll be happy to leave this with your staff.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Representative Beard.
Technical question, Mr. Chair. Your eastern basin supply was 126. Does that include Marcellus Shale? And second question is, define decatherm for the new members, please.
The answer to your first question, no, it doesn't. We have some shale. There is some shale development down in Texas.
But that would be additional reserves coming online.
That's additional reserves. One of the problems with shale is that it tends to have a very high production curve. Mm-hmm. You get a lot of natural gas real quickly, and then a very steep decline in production. Now, there's still a lot of gas there, but it takes a while to get that. So a lot of that development of that type of natural gas depends on the economics. When natural gas prices are high, people are going in it. A lot of people are doing shale development in the last couple of years. And, in fact, there's shale development, from what I understand, in western North Dakota?
Mm-hmm.
North Dakota. I didn't know if it was north or south.
As well.
And then, I'm sorry, sir, you're
decatherm. Right. Define the term decatherm for us.
That's still out of focus. This is where my law degree is of no assistance. A decatherm, if I understand it, is the amount of energy that's required to raise a degree of water. I mean, basically, let me put it this way. On a cold winter, I'm trying to put it in ways I can. A decatherm is like a. You sound like you have a better.
A therm is a million BTUs, if I'm not mistaken. So is a deca then 10 times that?
Yeah, because it's 1,000. MMBTU, and a BTU is approximate, not an exact, but it's approximate to a third.
So these numbers we're looking at are your new business in that number? That's new business per day, decatherms a day, on your Northern Lights project?
Yes, that's 374,000 decatherms a day.
Wow. Okay. Thanks, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry. We are clearly out of time, Mr. Dougherty. I'm sorry we're going to have to ask you to come back another time. I apologize. We're going to try to get members here on time in the future. I have asked our committee legislative assistant to start recording as soon as we have a few technical details worked out, times of arrival and departure, which we're going to put in the minutes. Representative Paul, do you have a motion for us?
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'd move that we approve the minutes from the January 7th meeting and the January 12th meeting.
Mm-hmm. Are there any additions or corrections to those minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of their approval, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Minutes are adopted. Members, the meeting is adjourned.